we're going to try to talk around topics of future finance and how we restore and improve trust in financial services. So we'll start off with each of the panelists just saying a minute or two worth of opening remarks. We're looking for your questions. We'll bring your questions straight up and onto the panel, and we'll move around.
I want to talk about retirement security and retirement incomes and the finance profession looking at that. When I think back to my CFA studies and all the investment books I read, they're very strong on how you accumulate savings balances, how you invest to create balances and build things. But they're very weak on actually managing the drawdown phase when people are taking income out and looking to try and grow capital at the same time. But I think this is going to be one of the big challenges for the 21st century, retirement security. Aging populations, increased longevity, slowing labour force growth, and very low interest rates will make the provision of adequate retirement incomes very difficult. Most countries have a three-pillar retirement system, with the national pension system supplemented by private savings in a private pension form and individual savings. But poor demographics will make the provision of national pensions much harder, resulting in lifts in the retirement age and probably reduced eligibility. But for private pensions, there's a switch away from defined benefit plans which pay out incomes to defined contribution. And I run a defined contribution plan, and what's really clear is that when the beneficiary bears the investment risk, it generates a whole lot of behavioural issues. These people have got long investment horizons, but an unwillingness to bear the risk associated with building balances during those long investment horizons. They're poorly equipped to handle the risk. So it's an interplay between financial planning and behavioural finance, if you like. Even worse, the current low interest rates don't provide an alternative and potentially increase the risk of an adverse outcome. So I think building portfolios in for those in retirement is a key area which finance needs to work and develop. We need to answer such questions as what is risk? Is it annual volatility or insufficient income? How do we handle large drawdowns in the context that people can't contribute? Annuities should be the solution, but they're expensive and the returns are too low. And then finally, how do we address the inflation risk? That's the biggest of all risks for people in retirement. So there's a lot of questions to answer, and we don't have many skills in our, or many tools in our kit bag to handle those questions.
If you look at what happened in the last 15 to 20 years, there has been two fundamental changes in the industry. One is the SRO. This is way back 15 years ago, 10 to 15 years ago. And I'm not sure if you remember that time, where the banks were self-regulating. The regulators did not want to do too much in terms of regulating the big banks. And you know that is a very, I guess, everyone drank from the same Kool-Aid. Everyone knew that they were regulating themselves. And that was, at that time, considered a good thing. Everyone was on that bandwagon. And the other big development that has developed over the last 15, 20 years has been the issue of compensation. And the compensation, everyone was given call options. You were encouraged to take risks, and it was a very cheap call that you were endowed with when you took over the organization. So if you think the compensation, about the compensation, the revolution in the compensation area of our industry, with the SRO, self-regulating, just imagine you could regulate yourself and you could pay yourself. That were the two prime scenarios that could create all kinds of problems. And we see the creation of all these little problems that we now face, the principal agency problems, the transparency problem, hiding behind a cloak of complexity to engage risk. The trading of risk has now gone from the side of the banks to everybody else. So they are involved in the flow process. They're not involved in the ownership of their risk process. So, you know, that interconnectivity comes as a result of this prime setting from these two, you know, these two environments that gives such fodder to the creation of these issues that we see. So I think it helps, from my standpoint at least, to be able to see what's the prime contributor to these little agents, principal agent problems will always be there. The question is, what are the conditions that we set so that, you know, it reduces the ability of these agency problems to grow in an uncontrolled fashion? And again, when everyone drinks from the same Kool-Aid, when everyone's involved in SRO, you got a prime setting of systemic risk, right? So I think the regulators, the banks, and the investors, including the CFA Institute, have looked at this long and hard. And it's also important, I think, to look at it from a kind of a framing standpoint to figure out what's wrong. Because the future of finance, to figure out what's going to happen in the future, we got to figure out what went wrong. And I think a lot of people have very different ideas of what went wrong. But again, we need to figure out what are the conditions that caused these problems. And I guess we'll be talking more about this from the bottoms up.
Good. Okay, well, let's get into a question. What is it that we can take away from the Asia-Pacific finance models and apply globally to improve the world's financial system to restore trust? What would you point to?
For people who are in their 40s, they're in a lot of developed countries, 50-50 to live to 90. So if they retire at 60, they're going to be retired, some of them, for as long as what they were working. And so retirement as a notion is something which could well be reviewed over history, but the key thing is if people are going to retire, they're going to need lots of money put aside, and they have all the similarities of providing a fair amounts in doing so.
So we have the growth of large asset owners in Asia-Pacific, in Australia in the form of the defined contribution pools, and in places like Singapore and China in the form of large pools of reserves or other savings. And then we have asset managers. And Aaron talked about the agency, the principal agency conflict. And then another data point would be this proposed legislation in Europe to cap the compensation of investment managers. So my question is, and this is a question coming from the audience as well, is what can asset owners do to change the behavior of agents? Should they be more public about norms? Should there be private pressure put on asset managers to reduce agency conflicts? Aaron, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, I think that the cost of doing due diligence is going to go up. And then we're beginning to see a lot of, I think, fund of funds. We're seeing asset owners trying to shrink. They're more concentrated in the allocation towards external managers, external, owners of the secondary set of operations. And I think that's the cost that we're paying right now. And we're seeing smaller funds get smaller and shrinking. We're seeing bigger funds get bigger. So it seems to be gravitating towards a more trust thing, a more big brand, IBM kind of a picture. So definitely the principal agent problem is very real. Asset owners are faced with a wide variety. If you think about Madoff, where you don't know the crisis until it's right in your face. Those kind of fear is still very dominant in people right now. And certainly, I just go back again, it's kind of a little bit connected because Asia and the West is very different right now because they're very, not only are they on different parts of the development curve, but the current situation is very different. The West is facing a huge shrinkage in the financial sector. And Asia is, on the other hand, expanding its financial sector. But Asia's real sector is probably, manufacturing sector is probably shrinking because of the export base. But the financial sector is actually increasing. And all this QE stuff has exported huge amounts of liquidity to Asia. And the Asian economies have a problem trying to handle that kind of a situation. We've got too much money going into various investments. In that kind of a situation, obviously there are plenty of, projects that could be up, which are maybe bad projects to begin with, but you have to do the real diligence to figure out how to allocate your money. I'm sure those of you who are in in insurance find it very hard to be able to get to meet your liability targets, and then you're desperate to be able to kind of invest that amount. So we're feeling all kinds of problems, and I fear that this liquidity, if it goes unchecked, is going to give rise to other problems that would come up in the future. And certainly, I don't think Asia has a very good and long history of how to manage this kind of crisis. If you go back to 97, Asia went through the mother of all crises for the region during the banking crisis years, and it learned a lot. I mean, I've seen Korea just change phenomenally. So they were kind of insulated from some of the problems they had in the West. But now the problem is how to handle these huge amounts of liquidity. You're seeing all kinds of asset bubbles in Asia. We're seeing real estate certainly to levels we've never seen before, and certainly not commensurate with the wage base. And those are clear problems. China has the real estate problem. We have the real estate problem, and there's no way to control this with the amount of liquidity that we have. And those are situations that can give rise to more of these agency problems that we face.
Let's kind of bring focus back into some basic concepts, some principles. So there's a question about the fiduciary duty, the concept of a fiduciary. And Mark, in Australia, with the growth of these defined contribution plans, yes, on the one hand, people are asked to take responsibility for their own investment decisions, but on the other hand, plan design and product design is pretty carefully defined, as I understand it there. Can you talk about some lessons that you've learned? What would you do with the concept of fiduciary duty, as you understand it in Australia, to actually improve finance at a broader scale beyond Australia itself?
The first thing is that it's always somebody else's money. So it's not your money. You're investing on behalf of people, and it's somebody else's money. The second thing to remember is that the people you're investing on behalf of have a lot less money than you do. So you're investing on people who live next door, or your mother or somebody else. So you have to think about other people's money and how you'd look after other people's money. The finance industry lost sight of fiduciary duty and replaced fiduciary duty with self-interest. And this is what we ended up with. So you have to think about other people's money, what they need to achieve with their money, and how can you build products which best achieve that outcome. Not products which sound sexy, complicated. I've got these rules that, look, the more complicated it is, the worse the outcome's likely to be. Another thing I've got here is that you have to protect their interests and their money. So I don't like investing in intermediary structures. If we can maintain direct ownership of the assets, it gives us the overarching security around the assets. And probably the third thing, and the most important thing when you're exercising fiduciary duty, is that you have to watch out for what I call knowledge imbalances, where someone comes to you who's got more information or more knowledge than you and says, this is a really good idea, you should follow me. That's always turns out to be a disaster. They get rich and you lose money. So the key thing about fiduciary duty, I think, and how we build products and how we think about it, is that it's other people's money, and it's about looking after other people and not looking after ourselves.
Well, we're also talking about systemic risk, and so we've got a question which kind of transcends future finance and market issues. A question about what your opinion is of the top two or three sources of global financial systemic risk now. And I guess, Aaron, from your comments, I'd assume that would be the extremely easy money policy that's been sustained by central bankers. But in addition to that, so if we take that as one of the top two or three, would you have one or two others you'd share?
Well, yeah. I guess it's very hard to figure out where this risk will arise. It certainly is systemic. I think no one, if you go back 6-7 years, no one would have figured that subprime would be as big a risk as it eventually turned out to be. No one would have figured that Greece would have been as big a systemic risk as it turns out to be. But I think you have to look at the conditions that set up this risk, because once you got the prime conditions, every little thing, it could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. And Greece was the one that broke Europe's back. Subprime was one of many things that broke the U.S. back. And in Asia, who knows? So I think if we can identify that we are living in a situation where the conditions are prime for excessive risk-taking, that at some point something's going to break. But it's very hard to figure out what is going to be the straw that actually does it.
The things that strike me as being particularly dangerous, on top of the ones mentioned, they are inappropriate financial innovation. People think up a new product, and the interplay of innovation plus leverage and poor regulation set up the preconditions for all these things to happen throughout history, and this has been the most recent episode.
And just want to add to that too, because I usually use an example. If you think about connectivity, monetary policy is as connected as it gets. And that's also considered a source of risk. Why I say that, you have in the West the mother of all crisis, and you are pumping in steroids to a very sick patient. And what we're seeing in Asia, we are importing those steroids because of monetary policy. And if you apply steroids to a healthy patient for a long enough time, the patient will surely die. And that potentially could be a future problem if it goes on a prolonged basis. Now, I can tell you that inflation in Asia could be higher than the levels that we see or purport to see in the numbers throughout Asia. But we're seeing mortgage rates at a historical low. So it's not a surprise to see housing going beyond the reach of almost every common folk, except the hedge funds or the institutions that have set up private equity funds to buy those properties. And so we got to see the signs. We got to see the signals before it's just too late. And the weakness in our system right now is has not been a monetary policy reform in Asia. It's all pegged to maintaining the currency rate, and we are importing interest rates that's just not suitable for the rate of economic growth that we see.
So back to retirement security. Mark, in Australia, it's been 20-plus years of disciplined and progressively higher savings, mandated savings into these pools. So, and that is either correlated with or coincided with a remarkable positive period for Australia's economy, thanks to the growth of China and what have you. So my question is, you know, in the inevitable downturn in Australia and other places, what safeguards need to be put in place to ensure that raids don't occur on these pools of savings, which has happened, of course, in other places in periods of extreme stress? You feel a level of comfort that those mechanisms are in place and maybe there's lessons to be learned?
They recently tried to put up the taxes on retirement savings in Australia, and the outcry was enormous. Now, people have forgotten that they cut the taxes 4 years earlier, unsustainably, but nonetheless, the outcry was enormous. The reason was because it was enormous was because these were people's individual accounts. So once they're individual accounts, the ability to the government to use them for other purposes is dramatically reduced. But if you think back to what happened in Argentina in the 2000s, it's not impossible to see them being used in an absolute emergency. Mm. So it's dramatically reduced, but not prohibited. Mm-hmm.
This concept of financial repression, which we heard in one of the breakout sessions, where governments are forced through various apparently seemingly innocuous methods to basically transfer wealth from one generation to another. Do you have thoughts? Anybody have thoughts on that? What the industry can do, if anything?
You know, transfer of wealth. You know, one of the things that I figure, you know, if you look at the case of Japan, if you look at the case of countries right now, unfortunately, we're not sticking with the original, what the economic models are, economic policy should be. If you're thinking about too big to fail, you are maintaining the status quo. You are allowing the guys who took excessive risks in the past, who blew everything up, and you are allowing them to keep their wealth. So, you know, I've always thought about Japan, where it should be growing at this rate. And what happened was Japan grew at a phenomenal rate, and it just stayed there. And I mean, in a normal economy, you would allow it to just crash and go back. So if you kind of maintain the growth, and it becomes a zombie economy, so it kind of levels off to where it should grow eventually. You see, if that's the situation, what are you doing essentially is to take away that growth from the future generation in order to keep the wealth for those who actually took excessive risk in this generation. Mm-hmm. So we, and if you take that and transplant that to the other economies, that also means that the young generation, the growth opportunities that they have the right to see is taken away from them because we in our generation have taken their share and we are not giving it back. And so if you ask the question, how do we transfer the wealth from one generation to another, I think that's going to be a rather difficult question to address because we're not aligned the economy to adjust to the penalties of taking excessive risk so that the young can have a better future when they have the opportunity to enjoy cheaper houses, cheaper costs, more jobs. I think it's a bigger question than just an intergenerational transfer. It's the whole setup. Is the world a better place for the next generation? Mm. And I'm not sure if it is right now.
Copyright 2013 CFA Institute. This program is designed to give accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is distributed with the understanding that CFA Institute is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, investment, or other expert advice. If legal advice or other expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.